This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Brian Cox, is one of the stars of the HBO series Succession, a social, political, family satire embedded in a drama. Cox plays Logan Roy, the patriarch in a family-owned business empire, Waystar Royco, that becomes publicly traded on the New York Stock Exchange. It includes a conservative cable news network, cruise lines, theme parks, and more. His daughter and sons are competing over who will succeed their aging father when he's ready to step down or dies. Logan is all about power plays that will lead to more power and more money with little regard for ethics, morality, or the consequences of his actions on the lives of others. When Logan's son Kendall asked Logan if he ever thought that Kendall could take over, here's how Logan responded.
You're not a killer. You have to be a killer.
That wasn't a fair assessment, because Kendall went on to prove he did have killer instincts as he tried to take down his father. Ruthlessness is a trait that Logan succeeded in passing on to his children. Cox won a Golden Globe for his performance in Succession and is now nominated for a Screen Actors Guild Award. He's written a new memoir called Putting the Rabbit in the Hat. It begins in Dundee, Scotland, where he grew up after nearly dying at birth. Let's hear another clip from Succession. In this scene, Waystar Royco is being investigated by the Justice Department, and Logan's daughter Shiv is worried because she knows about the whistleblowers and the intimidation of victims. Shiv is played by Sarah Snook.
Can we talk?
Yes, we can talk.
Okay, well, we're a big company, but how bad is... What is the worst thing?
Not all that
bad.
I mean, you know, health, safety, compliance, a few bad apples. What?
Well, I know that isn't true. Come on, Dad. Tom worked in cruises. Bill told him everything. And besides, I know that there were black ops, and I know that there was targeted intimidation of victims and whistleblowers. The NRPI, say.
Maybe there were some salty moves.
You can't just change your story.
I want to keep you clean. I put Jerry in, but I can't trust her. She's optics. I need you. Listen. I didn't know about any of this.
Well, you're on emails.
Do you know how many emails I get a day? I don't read my emails. I get the action points.
I know.
Shiv, the world is rough. We ran a cruise line out of some tin pot ports registered in Bongo Hovels, and we poured millions in it. Sure, did we play rough with the odd union boss or some moaning mini repeat litigant? I don't know. It was a quarter of a century ago. A lot of it. So, yes, I fought for you and your brothers. But you will not find a piece of paper that makes you ashamed of me. Okay?
Well, the government does have an unbelievable amount of leverage at its disposal, Dad. The law?
Yeah, the law. The law is people. And people is politics. And I can handle the people.
Brian Cox, welcome to Fresh Air. It is such a pleasure to have you back on the show. I love Succession and I love you in it. So welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Good to be back. Good to be back, Terry.
The last line in the scene that we just played is so good. The law is people and people is politics and I can handle the people. That's such a memorable line. Like, that's going to be a quoted line. So when you saw that line, did you think like, wow, this is a good one?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many good lines in the show. And, you know, he's an extraordinary character, Logan. I mean, he's probably one of the most extraordinary characters I've ever played, because he is not what he appears to be. This is the interesting thing about Logan. I mean, he seems to be like this demon. And of course, he is a misanthrope. You know, he is very disappointed with the human experiment. He and I both share that, except he's a pessimist and I'm an optimist. So that's the big difference between both of us. So at the same time, he's got a history, but he's also, you know, he's not, he just tells it like it is. And he's a truth teller, and it's not pleasant, and people don't like it. And they always suspect his motives. But his motives are always to do with the business. It's always to do with the firm. It's always to do with the what he's created. That's his concern. But Roman then does, he said, well, what are you doing it for? And he says, well, maybe love. And of course, this is like a red rag to a bull, because there isn't a lot of love coming from his children. You know, they talk about love, but, you know, he loves them, but where's the reciprocal? I mean, they just see him as a cash cow, you know, so much of the time. And that's the dilemma of the part, you know, is the fact that he's constantly caught on this dilemma of loving his children, but finding them constantly wanting as individuals.
Okay. I have to stop you here and say, I love that you are totally describing this from the point of view of your character, Logan Roy. What yes, you are leaving out here is the fact that he has no morals, he has no ethics, and if his children are spoiled and come up short on things, it's because that's how he brought them up. He brought them up, it seems like he brought them up, manipulating them, teaching them to fight for power, to fight with each other among, you know, for power. He's totally manipulative of them. He shows them no love. So, but you're really seeing it from his point of view.
I don't think he's capable of expressing love in that way. I think that's his problem.
That is a problem.
That's his difficulty.
That's, you know, a big problem.
He's not, he can't do it because, just again, because of his background, you know, the historical inevitability of your own relationship, what you come through, who you become out of what you become or what you are, is always the kind of crux of any individual. You know, we are the sum of our history, and Logan is the sum of his history, which is a mysterious history and is a thwarted history. And I mean, I don't defend Logan in any way, but I also, you know, one of the jobs as an actor is we cannot judge our characters, but at the same time, we have to have a kind of eye on where our characters are. We've got to see them for, you know, in terms of the narrative of the show, in terms of what is required at any given moment.
You asked the writers, does Logan love his children? Why did you need to ask? And how did the answer affect your performance?
I needed to know because is he vain? Is he just cruel? You know, is he needlessly cruel? Because I thought, if he's needlessly cruel, this is going to be a very boring show for me. You know, I'm going to be playing one line throughout. And Jesse said, no, he loves his kids. So that's always the tension in his life, is that he actually loves his children. But constantly, and partly his responsibility, because of the way he's brought them up. But, you know, there comes a point, I mean, I remember the great actor Brian Dennehy saying this to me, and I always remembered it. He said, you know, after a certain age, all bets are off. You can blame your parents for everything, but finally there's a point where you've got to say, hang on, you know, you know, I'm 30 now. I can't just keep blaming my mum and dad for my conditioning. You know, there's a point where I have to use my own intelligence and say, hang on, let me get the perspective on this. And of course, this is what human beings sometimes, a lot of the time, fail to do.
Are there other questions that you've asked the writers of Succession?
Not many. No, I tend not to. I don't work in that way. I mean, the key question for me was, when does he love his children? Because once you have that, once you establish that, then the conflict is there. You know, however inner the conflict is, and we don't see it. That's the other thing about Logan. We don't see a lot of what's going on in his inner thinking. And he's angry. He's an angry man. He's a very, very angry man. And he's angry because of his own wants and his own frustrations that he can't, you know. He's created this monster, this thing. And at the end of the day, he loves it. It's his creation. But at the end of the day, it's highly questionable morally.
So, yes, he shows a lot of anger. He's an angry man. How do you play his anger? What do you want to show, and what do you want to kind of withhold when you play his anger?
Well, his anger is about the fact that his anger is based on the stupidity around him. You see, the other thing about Logan is what people forget. He fires people and rehires them. This is what he's done. He has a team. There's two families in the show, you know. There's the kids, but there's also the people he's worked with for the last 30, 40 years. Jerry, Frank, Carl, you know, his financial manager, financial director. And what really is interesting about that, from my point of view, is he is shown to them, even though he's treated them in sometimes a really appalling way, there's something that's ultimately loyal about his relationship to his staff, which people don't even notice. They never notice it because they think, oh, well, he's this, you know, he's capricious in a way. You could say there's an element of caprice, but there's also an element of constantly testing people, constantly testing their loyalty. And it's exhausting, you know. And he has a lot of respect. And he can be curiously offhand, like when he says, I mean, Jerry, he has a lot of respect for, but then he says things like, you know, well, she's a million years old. What are you talking about? You know, that stuff, you know. And this just comes out because of his own element of ignorance, you know, about human relationships.
But let's get back to playing his anger.
Well, his anger comes from his childhood. It comes from his lack, that, you know, and I have personally a lot of anger in myself. Partly because of my background, you know.
Which we'll get into, yeah.
Which I didn't realize. So the anger is something I can relate to. I can relate to his anger. And he has this relationship with his sister Rose, which we never discover. We also have the relationship with Elspeth, his mum. He's named his journalist center. So there is this sense of family in him, which is quite complicated. Because at the same time, it's his burden. You know, he wish he could, you know, as we all do. We all wish we could get rid of certain stuff, but we can't. That's why it's an interesting role to play, because there is a background that we don't even explore. We never see him other than we see him through other people's eyes. And we hear him and we see him and we go, but we never, there's never a moment where, you know, like they did with Tony Soprano, where he sits down and goes and sees a psychiatrist and he can talk certain ways. We don't do that. We never expose that element of him. But from the acting point of view, you have to store all that stuff up, even though you don't play it. And anger is one of the key things.
I want to ask you about your birth. You were born after your mother had 4 or 5 miscarriages, and you nearly died in childbirth. Can you explain the complications of your birth?
Yeah, it was a horrendous thing for my poor ma. I mean, she was the one that really suffered because when I came into the world, I brought half a womb with me as well at the same time. Yeah, I mean, it was a struggle for her, and she was quite ill. She'd had several miscarriages before me, and she was 40, I think, when I was born. Yeah, she was 40. Or she was coming up to 40. It was horrendous. It was a horrendous birth. And, of course, you know, the whole thing about that sort of working class thing is you just put up with it. You know, there was no complaints. I remember that, you know, my first wife, you know, we lost twins. And my mother came to stay, and my mother had this expression, which is, I'll have to do it in a Scottish accent because that's... So when I was saying, you know, Caroline, my wife, I said, I'm worried about Ma. She said, you know, because the twins and losing the twins. And she said, Bren, we've had drop bairns, which is an extraordinary thing to say, which was, we've all dropped babies. So this was like a common thing among, you know, the women, you know, the miscarriage wasn't something that was, you know, unusual. It was a process that women horrifically went through. You know, I mean, horrifically. And my mom was part of that, you know.
So when you were born, among the complications was that the umbilical cord was wrapped around your throat. Your legs were in the wrong position.
Yeah. I came in arse first.
Yeah, and as you say, your mother was physically and emotionally scarred by the birth.
Terrible.
Did she talk with you about, like, did you, how old were you when you found out how difficult the birth was and the impact it had physically and emotionally on your mother?
I kind of got it when I was really quite young. I mean, I think my mom told me eventually after she was, you know, she'd been ill and she came home briefly, but she was never the same. You know, she had electric shock treatment. So a lot of her memory stuff had gone, short-term memory had gone, long-term memory was fine. So she did tell me about the birth, you know, and I was kind of, you know, it was a miracle, you know, because I did have the cord wrapped around my neck and I did come, I don't know what I must have thought. I mean, what I felt was, and I was the other way around as well, that's why I came, because obviously I was heading towards the birth canal and I thought, there's no way I can get through here, so I had to turn around, you know, and went the other way, you know, which was... it's a weird, weird thing.
Your father, when he died, you were 8 years old. No one had told you that he'd been diagnosed 3 weeks before with pancreatic cancer, so you were shocked. And so you lost a father, you lost his love, you lost his income, you lost the security of having a family that was, I mean, you were poor after he died. So how poor were you?
Oh, well, yeah, we were really poor. Well, I suppose the worst example, it didn't happen all the time, but the example of it would be, we get to a Thursday night, and my mother got a pension on the Friday, and we wouldn't have any food. So I would go across to the fish and chip shop across the road from us, and I would, he was great, Mario, you know, he Carino, and he would say, and I would go in and I'd say, listen, can I have some batter bits? Now, batter bits are the bits that lie at the back of the pan, and he would give me a bag of batter bits, and that would be our dinner. It didn't happen all the time, but it did happen at least, I think, 3 times.
You fell in love with movies. What were some of the movies that you fell in love with at an early age?
Well, really, there's so many movies. I mean, and it's a kind of wide scale, actually. I mean, my stuff was... My mother was a Spencer Tracy. I mean, my mother adored Spencer Tracy. So any Spencer Tracy film, I was immediately sent to see, even though I was still young. But of course, I loved Martin and Lewis. That was the other thing, Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis. Those movies, not Lewis later on, but Dean Martin and Lewis. Danny Kaye, my favorite film of all times, my favorite comedy is The Court Jester with Danny Kaye, which is, I absolutely adore that movie. And I always responded, there was nothing, English films didn't, you know, I'm a Scot, so English films didn't mean anything to me. Whereas American films, I identified with immediately because they were all, you know, Cagney and people like that, they were all Irish immigrants, a lot of them, Tracy, you know. So they all came from the same Celtic stock. So, and somehow the films resonated.
So your period of becoming an actor coincided with this new period of social mobility where working class actors...
The greatest time.
...were becoming accepted and working class stories started being told in movies in England. Did you feel like your accent or your background ever held you back, either in your training at the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art or in your access to roles?
I mean, it did in a way. I mean, it's a feudal society and it's everybody in their place. And the great thing about the 60s is that anything was possible. You were encouraged to be who you were. You were encouraged to be able to talk in your own accent. And all of that started to change. Though, ironically, the Scottish thing didn't kick in till later. So actually, I ended up playing, when I started out, playing a lot of Liverpool people or Yorkshire. I did David Story plays. So I played a lot of Yorkshire people. You know, I did a film and then I did a couple of plays in that way. So that was the sense of social mobility. And the other great influence, of course, at the time, was what was happening in music, because it was the time of the Beatles, it was the time of the Rolling Stones, it was the time of the Who, the Kinks. So the music thing had burgeoned, and those guys, I mean, when I watched that wonderful documentary with Paul McCartney, that thing from Get Back from those days when they recorded the last album. It was like, it moved me to tears, because that was the energy that was so in the atmosphere that anything was possible, that we could do it. And it subsequently dissipated horribly because of everybody saying, oh, just remember who you are, you know, and it's still as futile as it ever was. And the people won't even see it because it's kind of hidden. It's in the fabric of the society.
Was your character on Succession initially supposed to be American?
Well, he's sort of partly American. I always had the idea, you know, that Logan Roy could be Scots. I thought, Logan Roy, it's a Scottish name. So I thought, man, he could be Scots. I suggested it to Jesse. He said, no, he has to be American. He's got to be American. I said, okay, fine, so I'm American. So I played it for 9 episodes in the first season. And then on the 9th episode, Peter Friedman, who plays Frank, had done an ADR session. He came to me and said, you know, they've changed your birthplace. Because originally I was born in Quebec, and, you know, I travailed around, but I was originally born in Quebec. That was the idea. And I said, what do you mean they've changed my birthplace? I said, well, yeah, you're no longer in... you're no longer born in Quebec. And he'd done a big speech about in the first episode. And I said, so where am I born? He said, oh, I can't remember. And he looked at his device. He said, yeah, here we are. Somewhere called Dundee, Scotland. And I went, yeah, but that's where I'm from. He said, oh, that's a coincidence. And I said, I'm not sure if it is a coincidence. And I went to Jesse. I said, what the hell was going on? Oh, he said, we thought you'd be a little surprised. I said, it's a hell of a surprise. I've been acting this character for 9 episodes, thinking he's born in Quebec, Canada, with a kind of, mutt Vermont Canadian accent. And I said, now I'm a Scot. And he said, yeah, well, we just thought it was more interesting. You know, so it was kind of bizarre. That whole thing was totally bizarre.
Did you have to redo anything?
No. Didn't have to, because he's got it. Because he's lived in America, you know, and basically he's been, we slip in and out, so it kind of works that I do it, you know. I mean, and when I was a kid, of course, when I was a little boy, I mean, I ended up playing movies. I was always doing American accents right from the age of about 5.
What do you hear in American accents?
What do I hear? Ease. Ease of sound. I think sometimes it's, I do worry about Americans not enunciating things. And as I get older, I get a little bit more hard of hearing about, you know, so I think kind of goes like that, you know, a little bit. But also it's ease. It's also, it is the language of an egalitarian society, because it's not, you can't, I mean, of course, you've got the regions and you've got the various influences, like in the Appalachians, you've still got the Scottish influence, actually, down there. But it's what has been attractive, and it's also a passionate accent. It's a great it's a great one for an argument, you know. And so I like it. But as I get older, I go more and more towards English, because I go more and more for clarity. And sometimes Americans isn't always clear, you know.
I want to talk with you about the musicality in your line readings. And what I want to do is play the same clip that we heard earlier, an excerpt of that clip. And there's a line I particularly want to ask you about, and it's the line where you say, we're talking about misdeeds from a while ago, and you say, I don't know, it was like a quarter of a century ago, a lot of it. So let's listen back to that clip, and then we'll talk.
Listen. I didn't know about any of this.
Well, you're on emails.
Do you know how many emails I get a day? I don't read my emails. I get the action points.
I know.
Shiv, the world is rough. We ran a cruise line out of some tin pot ports registered in bungo hovels, and we poured millions in. And sure, did we play rough with the odd union boss or some moaning mini repeat litigant? I don't know. It was a quarter of a century ago. A lot of it. So, yes, I fought for you and your brothers, but you will not find a piece of paper that makes you ashamed of me, okay?
Okay, it's so musical the way you do your lines, and the way you say things that, like, avoid responsibility. Like, you know, I don't know, it was a quarter century ago, a lot of it. So do you score your lines? Do you put pauses in, or like how do you approach it so that it ends up sounding just so ear catching?
I think I'm just gifted. You know, I have a God given gift, which is my voice. And I'm also one of the great things for me as an actor was to listen to voices of other actors. I remember years and years ago, John Henderson, who ran my first theater, when I listened to four different versions of Hamlet's not to be a Rogan peasant slave speech. I listened to Johnson Forbes Robertson. I listened to Ernest Milton. I listened to John Barrymore, who murdered it ridiculously. The best one was Johnson Forbes Robertson, who was so quick and so deft with the language. So language has always been the thing to me, and how you use language. And I have an instinct for it. It's just who I am. I mean, I'm blessed, but I've also had the training. And then I've worked with people like John Gielgud, who was an astonishing speaker of the verse and who really understood how to speak. Sometimes he even said to himself, when I was young, it was the voice beautiful, so I kind of did a lot of that stuff. And then Paul Scofield, who I think is, for me, the finest stage actor I've ever seen, bar none.
Can I stop you a second? You said that something about the voice beautiful. What are you referring to?
Well, Gielgud talked about when he was younger that sometimes he would say, you know, because I worked with him, I did Julius Caesar with him, and he said, you know, when I was younger, I started off well, but then I started to listen to myself a little bit, you know, I could hear that, and you can hear it in his voice that he started to trill it a little bit. The thing about it, Terry, is that you've always got to base it in the truth. It's subject, verb, and object. You know, that's what you have to base it in. It's simple grammar. And when you understand the principles of grammar, then the cadences of the voice take on those principles. It's as simple as that. But if you don't understand subject, verb, and object, and a lot of people don't, a lot of actors don't, a lot of American actors don't, they see it emotionally and they don't see it in terms of clarity. You know, I mean, the emotional thing, of course, has got to be there, but that's a given. But the thing is clarity, and the thing is actually making the audience listen to you. How do you make an audience listen to you? And you make the audience listen by being clear and by inhabiting the line, by understanding where you are in the line. And this goes right back to Shakespeare and the iambic pentameter. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune and by opposing end them. You know, that's what you have to understand.
Since you're into looking at a script in terms of subject, object, verb, and not just like, what is the emotion here, do you actually like grammatically dialogue sentences, or do you just think of like, what is the intent of this?
That's what I do. I mean, I just do it automatically. And of course, it does feed the emotion. And of course, the anger, all the stuff that I have, you know, I don't have any problem with any of that stuff. My problem is to be more discreet, to be, you know, and that's the learning process. Even as I continue in my 70s as an actor, is that's what I'm doing. I'm constantly adjusting to find out, to get it more finer, what I'm doing.
You've worked with many actors, and you've worked with many actors with different approaches to acting. You don't personally subscribe to like the method approach where you dig down into your own emotional memory to play the character, or where you stay in character while on set, even when you're not on stage or in front of the camera. But you've worked with actors who do have that approach. And you mentioned Daniel Day-Lewis, who you worked with in the film The Boxer, and how he would stay in character. What impact does it have on you? When you're not staying in character, when you're not in front of the camera, but an actor who you're working with is staying in character?
Well, it's. I'm afraid it's a question of horses for courses, really. There's a one particular horse and one particular course, and they pursue that course, and that horse pursues that course. My thing about what I feel is that you've got to be able to walk away. You've got to be able to turn on a dime. You can't get over attached, because once you're over attached, you lose your sense of perspective. And with anything in drama, you've got to have the perspective of what you're doing. You know, you've got to keep perspective going, because that's the momentum of the whatever is happening within the given play or film or TV, the drama. So I find that Dan was fascinating. He was great, and he's a great actor. And also, you know, I'm not going to knock that, because I think whatever gets you through the day, fine. The only problem is the effect it has on the community. Now, when we've got actors all working in a certain kind of way, and there's a sort of, there are demands that are made that are seemingly selfish or self-serving, it becomes really, really problematic.
There's a now famous profile in the New Yorker of Jeremy Strong, who plays one of your sons in Succession. He plays Kendall. And apparently he stays in character and wants to get so deep into the role that when he was playing Yippie leader Jerry Rubin in the Trial of the Chicago 7 movie, during a scene with a clash with the police during a protest, he wanted real tear gas to be used, which, of course, Aaron Sorkin decided against when he directed the film. But I think he's great. I think Jeremy Strong is great as Kendall in Succession. But are there issues for you in terms of your approach being in conflict at all with his approach?
Well, I try not to make that happen, because I will deal with it, and if it's working within the scene, that's fine. But I'm not going to attach myself to it, because otherwise you become, you know, it distracts you, and I won't be distracted. You know, that's the important thing. I've got to do my job, you know.
So like when you're not in front of the camera, it's hard for you to engage with somebody who's staying in character. That's going to get in your way. But as long as the work is good, that's fine. As long as
It doesn't get in my, I don't let it get in my way. I never let it get in my way, because I just accept that that's what they do. My worry is their responsibility to the community, because it's a communal thing. It's a group thing. It's not just about your performance. It is about all of our performances, and the harmony we create, and the tensions that we create within that harmony, you know. I mean the harmony in terms of we're all in the same, you know, we have the same intention of getting the program out and making it the best we can. So, you know, and that's my only question. That's the only thing that I go, no, you know. And that the group dynamic is very important. When you've got a great group dynamic, you always have a great show. And Succession is about the group dynamic. That's what's so powerful about Succession. And also, you get some great performances, including Jeremy Strong, in the middle of it, you know, and that's also great. But my thing is the group dynamic is very, very important.
So one more question, because I know you have to go. You know, you write about how your father was a confirmed agnostic, your mother was a fervent Catholic, although she came to question that when her mental health started to fail. You write that you think when we die, it's like turning off an appliance. It's just the switch is off, and it's as simple as that. How did you come up with that appliance analogy? And does it give you comfort to think that, to think like you die and that's it?
Well, I think so. You know, we have so many, you know, we have the whole God stuff, you know, and our whole, everything, our lives are all predicated on this idea of there's life after death, that it's this and that's the next thing. And I go, No, I mean, I just think it's energy, and when it's switched off, it's switched off. And when you go, you go, you know. You know, and there's all kinds of things. I mean, there's a very interesting thing that happened to my wife. My father-in-law passed quite recently, and this... I mean, I do think we're part of some kind of process. So I do think there's something going on other than the God thing. There is something going on with the whole business of life, that we are part of a big, huge experiment that's going on. And it was interesting, my wife, who's much more spiritual than I am, she said to her dad, you know, just before he died, he said, you know, send me a sign. And what happened was that when he died, they kept his body, and it was very because he was Iranian, her father. My wife is half Iranian. And normally they bury the bodies very quickly, but no, they kept the body for a couple of days, and people came and saw him, and he was in bed, dead. And on the last day, it was getting a bit smelly, so she opened the windows, and this robin flew in. And it flew around the room, and it sat. There was a photograph of our maternal grandparents who were both passed, and the robin sat there for a bit. And then it got up, and it flew, and it landed right on my late father-in-law's head and sat there for several minutes. And then it took off, circled, and then it flew off and flew out. So you go... This is astonishing. And my wife's got the photograph of her father with the bird sitting on his head. And it's... So you go, there's something, but I don't know what it is.
Brian Cox, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much. And thank you for your portrayal of Logan Roy. I love the show.
Thank you, Carrie. It's always good to talk to you. Challenging, but great in a good way.
Brian Cox is a star of the HBO series Succession. His new memoir is called Putting the Rabbit in the Hat. I was surprised to read in his memoir that he starred in a 1995 London revival of The Music Man. I don't associate him with musicals, so I thought it would be fun to hear him as Harold Hill.
Friends, may I have your attention, please? Attention, please. I can deal with this trouble, friends, with a wave of my hand, this very hand. Please observe me, if you will. I'm Professor Harold Hill, and I'm here to organize the River City Boys Band. Oh, think, my friends, how can any pool table ever hope to compete with a gold trombone? Ra 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 da 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 ra ra. Remember, my friends, what a handful of trumpet players did to the famous fabled walls of Jericho. Oh, billiard parlor walls come tumbling down. Oh, a band will do it, my friends. Oh, yes, I mean a boys' band. Do you hear me? I say River City's got to have a boys' band, and I mean she needs it right today. Well, Professor Harold Hill's on hand, and River City's going to have a boys' band. As sure as the Lord made little green apples, and that band's going to be in you. Uniform. Johnny, Willie, Teddy, Fred, and you'll see the glitter of crashing cymbals. You'll hear the thunder of rolling drums, the shimmer of trumpets, tantara, and you'll feel something akin to the electric thrill I once enjoyed when Gilmore, Liberati, Pat Conway, the great creator, W.C. Handy, and John Philip Sousa all came to town on the very same historic day. 76 trombones led the big parade, with 110 cornets close at hand. Then were followed by rows and rows of the finest virtuosos, the cream of every famous band. 76 trombones caught the morning sun, with 110 cornets right behind. There were more than 1,000 reeds springing up like weeds. There were horns of every shape and kind. There were copper bottom, timpani, and horse platoons, thundering, thundering all along the way.
This is Fresh Air.